PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
This week on PA Books, Michael Zhang, author of Guest of Adolf.
Michael Zhang is the author of Guest of Adolf, The War of Staff Sergeant Ernest V. Folk, 805th Tank Destroyer Battalion. Tell us about Ernest Folk. When did you meet him and when did you first start to hear these stories?
Well, I first met Ernie in probably 1972. I knew his daughter, Karen. Starting in 1969, we both attended Indiana University of Pennsylvania. We were both elementary education majors, so we had some classes together. Then, in the fall of 1972, I started dating Karen, and August of 1973, Karen and I were married. So really, I started forming a more close relationship with him starting in August of 1973. First hearing the stories, probably that summer. Unlike most veterans of wars, Ernie spoke freely of his experience. Someone could ask him what you did during World War II. Common question for members of the Greatest Generation of his age. And his response was always, I was a guest of Adolf, because he spent most of his overseas military career as a prisoner of war. He could talk your ear off. It got to the point as my children got older and they were out with their grandfather and someone would ask him that question, he would start talking your ear off and they would turn and say, well, Pappy has another one. So he could talk an hour and a half, if you let him, about his experience. So through the 30 years that I knew him, I gathered a lot of firsthand knowledge of what his experience in the various POW camps and his experience after being drafted in April of 1941.
Well, let's go back to his earlier childhood. Where did he grow up?
He grew up in Tyrone, Pennsylvania. He was one of seven children of Gerald and Mary Helen Folk. He lived in Tyrone. He was born in 1914. He was the second of their seven children. He graduated from Tyrone High School. He was active in some sports and other clubs in high school. Then after high school, he graduated in the middle of the Depression. So he first worked at a gas station. Then he worked at a coffee concern where he was driving truck between Tyrone and Baltimore. Then he landed his dream job, if you will, working in the paper mill that was in Tyrone. I say dream job because each job was a step up for him as far as finances were concerned.
You mentioned he was drafted. Talk about what was going on at that time. As far as what was happening in the world and the country at the point, was he expected to be drafted?
He wasn't expected to be drafted. So what was going on in 1940, the U.S. government approved two significant actions. One was the reinstitution of the draft in 1940. And also, 1940, we started mobilizing the National Guard divisions for a one-year training period. So in February of 1941, the 28th Division, Pennsylvania Army National Guard, was mobilized for their one-year period. Now, Ernie had registered for the draft back in November of 40. In early 41, he took his physical and went through all that and was considered draftable. And then in the end of February of 41, he received his draft notice that he was to report to the Altoona station for induction in April of 1941. So one of the unique things of the draft at that time is when a National Guard division was activated, the state needed to bring the units up to 100%. Most units at that time were less than 100% filled. So that's how he was drafted into a Pennsylvania National Guard unit, which was the 105th Infantry Battalion Anti-Tank. And then he reported, first he proposed to his longtime girlfriend, LaRue Cassidy. So he was engaged when he was reported for his 1 year mobilization. From Altoona, he moved to New Cumberland Army Depot. And there he was assigned to the 105th, which was at Fort Meade, Maryland.
What kind of training did he receive?
Well, he did go to basic training period like we think of today, where when you enlist, you go to your basic training. So his initial training was all at the unit level, what in the military we called SOJT, or supervised on-the-job training. So he had the training there. The unit was a relatively new unit because the unit was only formed in September of 1940, so it was a brand new unit in the Pennsylvania Guard. They didn't have a lot of equipment, so they had wooden guns that they used. They had very few vehicles at the time. So the training was kind of hit and miss. He went through certain basic training-like things. He used his truck driving skills, so he was assigned to drive truck. They had exercises at Fort Meade and then also down at Fort A.P. Hill, south of Fredericksburg, Virginia. So he did that. And then in the fall of 41, they participated in Carolina maneuvers. Most people have heard of Louisiana maneuvers and Carolina maneuvers. They were big army upon army exercises. So his unit participated. They were stationed around Hoffman, North Carolina, because maneuvers were both in North and South Carolina. And he writes about, you know, at that time, since they didn't have any artillery pieces, but they were an anti-tank unit, so they would sneak through the woods, blue on red forces. So he was in the blue force. They'd sneak up on the unit during an attack, and they'd throw bags of flour. So if the piece of equipment had flour on it, or the individual soldier had flour, they were out of the exercise.
So I want to jump forward to his overseas experiences. He first goes to England, correct?
Yes. August of 42, the unit goes to England. And by that time, they were now a tank destroyer battalion. So on December 1st of 1941, the infantry battalion's anti-tank were made into tank destroyers units, along with, there were eight of those units, along with 40 other created units, so they became a tank destroyer outfit. Their purpose was to really engage the German tanks and knock them out.
What type of equipment did they use?
At that time, they were using a half track with a 75 millimeter gun on the back of it.
And when did he go into combat for the first time?
The unit deployed to North Africa in January of 1943. They moved up to the front in starting in February, 1st of February, and then his unit entered the combat zone on February 14th of 1943.
What was that experience like for him? Did he write about it?
Yes, he wrote about the experience. That was a very short experience. So on the 14th of February, his company was moved up, which had three tank destroyer platoons, moved up to around Sabita in Tunisia, which is east of the Dorsal Mountains. So it was pretty far east at that time, the U.S. Army was. And then the company was then broken down into platoons, and sent to different areas south east of Sabita. So he and his platoon ended up on a small hill around Fade Pass by the 15th of February. They witnessed the beginning of the German offensive, which became known as the Battle of Kasserine Pass. So he was at the forefront of that. And then by the 16th, they were almost completely surrounded. And so the night of the 16th of February, everyone who was in that compound, because it just wasn't the tank destroyer platoon, you had infantry, you had artillery, you had different outfits there. They were all given the instruction for escape and evasion. So they destroyed their equipment that night, and they were given a walk this way to get back to around Sabita, which was a good 10 miles away. Over the course of the night, walking through the sand and everything, the platoon stopped to get a few hours rest. And apparently the sentries fell asleep, because when they got up in the morning, a German outfit had bedded down among them. Neither party knew the other was there until an American got up and started to do things, and then the Germans quickly responded, and so they were all captured.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
So this begins a long period of time as a prisoner of war. Initially, what was that experience like for him?
As he writes and talks about it, this is one of his diaries. This diary is his third volume, but this one doesn't talk about it in this one. In the first one, the experience that he wrote about, it wasn't a bad experience. The Germans treated them well. They searched them, but he kept his personal possessions, which he was very happy about, his shaving kit, personal things like that, some French money that he had. Most of his uniform items he got to keep. Of course, his weapon was taken away. So from around February 17th through the rest of that month, they moved through Tunisia. One of the interesting things that he talked about, so if you've ever seen the movie Patton, there's a scene in there where Field Marshal Rommel is walking towards an airplane, and you see a lot of American soldiers in a wire compound. So there was one Thanksgiving afternoon at my house where we were watching the movie Patton. It was after dinner, and Ernie was in our recliner, and he was sleeping. But when that scene came on, he woke up, looked at the TV, and said, "I was in one of those," and promptly went back to sleep. So that's a fond memory we have of him. But he throughout his experience, there are very few times that he's negative about his treatment. He does say something. There are times, but very few. He was a very loving Christian man who never talked ill about anybody. I never heard him talk ill about anybody. So his initial experiences were good. I would say so.
Now, during this time, he travels to Sicily and Italy, and eventually ends up in Germany. And one of the things that was kind of striking in the book was that he's receiving Red Cross packages throughout this time. Can you talk about how important those were and what they would have contained?
Well, the Red Cross packages are designed to be a supplement to the rations that the Germans would feed the prisoners. So he received his first one when he was in the Italian camp in Capua, which is outside of Naples. And that was an Italian camp, and it was a British parcel. So it didn't matter what country the parcels came from. He was just glad to get a parcel. The contents, they had cheese, maybe a tin of salmon, two different types of meat. There would be like sugar, powdered milk, orange drink, then the mix up, and cigarettes. Most of the packages had three packs of 16 cigarettes, and the cigarettes are important because they become money in the POW camps. He didn't smoke, so he had quite a hoard of cigarettes that he would write about.
He spent most of his time as a POW in Germany at a few different camps. And how were those camps organized? If you were to look at their barracks and, you know, where people lived inside the camps?
Well, I have looked at the barracks of Camp 7A outside of Moosburg in 2022. I did a trip over to Germany, a World War II trip. So the barracks, the camps were very well organized. So the barracks at 7A and also at 3B at Frankfurt on Oder, south at Fürstenberg, excuse me, on Oder, not Frankfurt, Fürstenberg on Oder. There were two main sections, and in the center, some of them had a latrine in the center. You might have a stove there and wash basins. The camp at Moosburg, the center just had wash basins and the heater. The latrines were separate buildings. These barracks were built to house 230 soldiers initially. But as the war goes on and the number of POWs increases and other factors, instead of having bunk beds, two, they added a third one. You would have stacks of three. So the barracks ended up sometimes with over 400 soldiers in them as the war progressed. As far as food was concerned, the Germans, for breakfast, a type of coffee, chicory coffee, bread, you might get some butter. If you were lucky, you might get some prunes with it. Lunch was primarily a soup, some type of vegetable. Again, if you were lucky, might get some meat. Evening meals, very similar, but lots of potatoes. Initially some meat, but by the fall of 44, meat became a rarity. So the Red Cross parcels were very important to supplement the rations. They were designed, I think I said, for one person for a week. But by the end of the war, they were being issued one for 12. So it didn't go very far.
Was he able to send and receive mail?
Yes. He received, so looking through his diaries, because every time he received the letter, he recorded it, that he received the letter. And every time he sent a letter, he recorded it. So looking through all his diaries and compiling that, he was mailed over 700 letters from the United States, and he sent close to 300 in response. Now, all of those letters didn't get through. My estimate was that only about 45% of the letters written either way ended up at the recipient, primarily lost in transit.
Now, a few times in the book, you mentioned that there were opportunities for him to leave the camp. He was in the Glee Club for a while, so he would perform for other prisoners, and he had opportunities to attend a concert in Munich.
Yes, so his experience and the way the way the camps were run initially from 43, I'd say, through early December of 1944 were much different than the last 6 months of the war. So when he was in Munich, he was selected, Camp 7A outside of Munich, he was selected to go to a concert in the city of Munich. When he was at the Camp 3B in Fürstenberg, yes, he was in the Glee Club the whole time. And they went out to what are called commando camps or sub camps, where soldiers who were privates through an E-4, equivalent of an E-4, went out to these work camps. And so they were maybe be on farms, maybe in a coal mine, different activities that were permitted by the Geneva Convention. So the Glee Club, band, and the camp leadership would go out to some of these sub-camps to perform. And the camp leadership was actually inspecting the camp. And then the musicians would attempt to smuggle food into the camp in their cases. And they were very successful, but the cases were inspected, and so the guards took some of the food, which was routine. So, like when he was waiting in line to take a shower, because the showers were outside of his compound, he made sure he had some food item on him. So the guards would, pat them down before they left, and he'd come back without that food item. So the guards were just as hungry as the POWs were in many instances.
As the war progressed and the Allies started to encroach more and more upon Germany, how did that affect how he was treated?
So starting in October of 44, Hitler said that I don't want to lose any of my prisoners of any type, whether they were in a concentration camp, a forced work camp, or the POWs. So as the Russians were moving westward through Poland, and there were all kinds of camps in Poland and the Baltic states, those prisoners were moved further into Germany. And most of the time, they moved by what I refer to as shoe leather express. In other words, they walked. If they were lucky, they were on a ship or a train or a truck for part of the trip. And some of those soldiers actually walked 1,000 miles from up in Estonia all the way down to Munich through the winter. So as that was happening, simultaneously, the Allies were bombing Germany very successfully. So they were destroying the rail and road networks. They were destroying the agriculture. And so food became in short supply. So it was kind of, his diary, he talks about, food, food, food all the time. That also contributed to the lack of the Red Cross parcels. So if you had, five boxcars load up in Berlin to move down to Fürstenberg, which is less than 100 miles, but there's no direct rail line, how do you move them? So there was a time he went about 40 miles south of the camp on a work detail to unload rail cars that had Red Cross parcels to bring them back to the camp.
When was he liberated?
So the Russians came into the camp around April 27th of 1945. However, he was liberated, but he wasn't, because the Russians held the prisoners in the camp. I think they held them for two reasons. One, it really wasn't safe outside the camp, so you have all these prisoners that are weak, not in top physical shape, but the war's still going on and they're unarmed. So you have German soldiers, pockets of them, still in the area. And so, unarmed POWs wandering in those, that would not be a pleasant thing, in my opinion. But the Russian also held them, in my opinion, as bargaining chips. One of the agreements of the Yalta Conference was at the war's end, all POWs were to be returned to their country. So if they were Russian soldiers, they had to be returned to Russia. If they were British, they had to be returned to England, and so on. Many of the Russian prisoners did not want to go back to Russia. So, there was some disagreement between Russia and the Allies, the individual Allies, Americans, British, and French, as to honoring that agreement. So I look at it akin to a couple, three or four-year-olds playing and one saying, well, I'm just going to pick up my ball and go home. So basically, it is, you give me mine, I'll give you yours. So May 7th is when he ended up back in Allied U.S. hands.
So we have just a couple of minutes left, and I just want to talk about that transition from captivity to returning home. What was that like for him?
So through the process, after about the first 10 days, he ended up on the French coast around Le Havre. And he saw that whole time, the next 3 weeks, as wasted time to him. He just wanted to get home. He wanted to get back to the United States. He wanted to get back to his fiancée, LaRue, which he eventually did on June 15th. So a little over about 40 days until he got back. And then they got married, honeymoon. He was still in the military. He ended up in Asheville, North Carolina, kind of like a rest area for a couple months. Then once he was discharged in September of 45, he found employment at the Mechanicsburg Naval Depot and just got on with his life like so many other World War II veterans. They packed up their experience in a box somewhere, put it on a shelf, and just moved forward, which he did.
We've been speaking with Michael Zhang. He is the author of Guest of Adolf, The War of Staff Sergeant Ernest V. Foch, 805th Tank Destroyer Battalion. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much, Phil.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books, as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.